at the end of the 40 years. And instead of taking that shortcut up to, because they were down here, instead of taking the shortcut up to Jericho, we talked last week about them taking a detour. The Edomites didn't want them to walk through their land, and darn it, I'm not sure I'm ever going to preach about detours again, because I think I've been on about 20 of them this week. It's like, I hate it when my own messages come back at me, you know, and all these things, you know, detouring me and making things take longer than planned, and I think it was just like the next day something happened, and I was thinking, oh, great. Here I go on a detour, and I'm supposed to be grateful for it. How about the Of course, I'll talk about detours again tonight. So we're not out of this. They are now camped out in what's called the Plains of Moab. And before they actually cross the Jordan River into the Promised Land, they need to take care of a few details. Namely, they're going to conquer the enemies that are on... See, the Jordan River extends up here. And they're going to take care of the enemies that live on the eastern side, on their eastern border. We're going to talk about some of these battles. So chapter 21, verse 21. Then Israel sent messengers to Sihon. Sihon, I practiced that a lot today. Sihon. You kind of have to... Sihon. Israel sent messengers to Sihon, king of the Amorites, saying, "Let me pass through your land." Now, Sihon, his name means warrior. His capital was the city of Heshbon, which is right here. And see, they're camped out right here. This is his city. This fight that they're going to have with this king is going to be a turning point for the nation of Israel. In fact, God actually considers this the beginning of the conquering of the Promised Land. Even though they're not on the other side of the Jordan River yet, this is still considered the beginning. In Deuteronomy, it will look back and say, "Rise, take your journey," and talk. It will look back and talk about this episode. And God said, "Rise, take your journey, cross over the river Arnon. Look, I have given into your hand Sihon the Amorite, king of Heshbon, and his land. Begin to possess it and engage him in battle. This day I will begin to put the dread and fear of you upon the nations under the whole heaven, who shall hear the report of you and shall tremble and be in anguish because of you." The process is going to begin. And the nations around them, when they see what God's going to do, they're going to all going to start shaking in their boots. Sihon, along with the next king that they're going to conquer, a fellow named Og. That sounds like a caveman or something. Og. Me, Og. I think he probably talked that way. Even though, for the most part, most of us don't know much about these guys. I'll bet most of us in this room have hardly even heard of Sihon and Og. And yet, these are quite significant parts of Israel's history. Sihon alone, outside of our passage here in Numbers, he's found in 27 other places in the Bible. The guy's all through the Bible. He's mentioned. Even Solomon, 400 years later, will talk about that part of the country on the other side of the Jordan as being Sihon's kingdom. This is a big deal that we're about to read. This whole battle is going to be so important God's going to use this to shake up their enemies. When they actually do cross over into Jericho, this is what Rahab says, who lives in Jericho. She says, "For we have heard how the Lord dried up the water of the Red Sea for you when you came out of Egypt, and what you did to the two kings of the Amorites who were on the other side of the Jordan, Sihon and Og, whom you utterly destroyed. And as soon as we heard these things, our hearts melted. Neither did there remain any more courage in anyone because of you, for the Lord your God, he is God in heaven above and on earth beneath." And there's a principle here. One victory builds on another. Oftentimes, if you will let him, God can take what might seem like not important victories in your life, and God will use that to encourage you to take more steps, to keep on going. You see this in David. When David faced Goliath, it wasn't the first time he'd ever fought in battle. No, in fact, when David faces Goliath, David said to Saul, "Your servant used to keep his father's sheep, and when a lion or a bear came and took a lamb out of the flock, I went out after it and struck it and delivered the lamb from its mouth. And when it arose against me, I caught it by its beard and struck it and killed it. Your servant has killed both lion and bear, and this uncircumcised Philistine will be like one of them, seeing he has defied the armies of the living God." David had already been in training when he faced Goliath. Goliath wasn't his first foe. He had already knocked off a few other things, and lions and bears, lions and tigers and bears. Oh my! I don't know if I'd face the lions and tigers and bears, but David has already learned how to fight in little battles. And sometimes, you know what, gang? Sometimes you and I face things that you and I think there's no way I'm going to knock this. You know, I don't know if you've ever struggled with an addiction. We've got a couple people in here who have found victory in addictions. And you might be in the place where you still haven't taken that first step because you're saying to yourself, there's no way I can do this. You know what? It starts with the first battle in front of you, and you face that. And you build on one battle after another. And so even though you might not know much about Sihon and Og, these are going to be the building blocks that God is going to use to help them conquer the promised land. He says, verse 22, it goes on. So Israel sent messengers to Sihon, saying, "Let me pass through your land. We will not turn aside into fields or vineyards. We will not drink water from wells. We will go by the king's highway until we have passed through your territory." But Sihon would not allow Israel to pass through his territory. So Sihon gathered all his people together and went out against Israel in the wilderness, and he came to Jahaz and fought against Israel. Now, this is the route of the Israelites. Heshbon is here, and he meets them here at this place called Jahaz, and he goes to battle with them. Verse 24. Now, I don't know if this sounded familiar, but this is the same thing that Israel said to the king of Edom earlier. They said, "Look, we'll just stay on the king's highway. We're not going to eat. We're not going to eat up all the food at your McDonald's. You know, we're going to just march right ahead. We're not going to hurt you or anything." And the king of Edom said, "No way, Jose." And they made a detour. Well, this guy says, "No way, Jose." And this time God says, "No, don't go detour. This guy I want you to take on." Now, the Edomites, God said, "No, don't touch the Edomites. You go around them. But this guy is not a friend." And so God's going to have them take him on. Verse 24, "Then Israel defeated him with the edge of the sword and took possession of his land from the Arnon to the Jabbok, as far as the people of Ammon, for the border of the people of Ammon was fortified." So Israel defeated him. Deuteronomy 31:4 says, "And the Lord will do to them," talking about the future inhabitants of the promised land, "He will do to them as he did to Sihon and Og, the kings of the Amorites and their lands, when he destroyed them." In future days, they will look back and say, "Look what God did. Look what God did." But it says in verse 24, Israel defeated him. I call this principle here, God's deliverance, my hand. We give God the credit. God's the one that engineered the whole thing. Surely it would not have happened without God. But if the Israelites weren't swinging their swords, it would have never happened. Sometimes we get the wrong idea when we hear, "God will deliver me from this." And we say, "Okay, God, take this away." And then he doesn't take it away. It's because he wants me to get up and use my sword and do something about it. I need to ask God for help, but sometimes I need to get up and do something. Now, there's times where absolutely God just takes care of stuff. You know, He said to Moses, just stand back and watch. I'm going to rout the Egyptians as they're crossing the Red Sea. You just stand back and watch. But there's times, gang, where you have to get up. You have to put your boots on and march forward. That you're going to see this in conquering a lot of the foes that you face. A lot of the demons that you face in your life, the difficulties. There are times where you have to get up and do something. You have to get away from the temptation. You have to say no to something. You have to flush the stuff down the toilet. You have to take action. And praying and saying, God help me, God deliver me, isn't going to help until you pick up your sword and do something and whack some Amorite heads off. Well, don't do that really. I mean, there's not real Amorites around. But you get what I'm saying? We have to take action. God's deliverance, my hand. Now it says they conquered them. His land was from the Arnon to the Jabbok. That's the territory of this fellow Sihon. Now, see, here's the Dead Sea. The Sea of Galilee's up here. And so there's a little creek called the Jabbok, and here's the river Arnon. And so this was Sihon's territory. This is modern Jordan. This city here, Rabbah, Jordan, that's where the modern city of Amman, Jordan, the capital of Jordan, is. And so they conquered this entire land. And all the way up, you see the... This Jabbok was the border of the Ammonites. Ammonites lived up here. God's going to not have them take on the Ammonites. This is the border of the Moabites. The Moabites are down here. And you're going to find out that God didn't want them to take on the Moabites. But the Amorites were different. God wants them to take them on. So verse 25. So Israel took all these cities, and Israel dwelt in all the cities of the Amorites, in Heshbon and in all its villages. Now, the Amorites were, that's supposedly a picture of ancient Amorites. I don't know. Whatever I found, I thought, well, I've got to show you pictures. Okay. These were some of the ancient people who were living in the land that one day Israel would conquer. Exodus 33 gives us a list of all the nations that God wants them to conquer. And one of the reasons this group is on the hit list for the Israelites is because this is a wicked people, and God has had it up to here. In Deuteronomy 9, it says, God is speaking to Israel, and he says, do not think in your heart after the Lord your God has cast them out before you, saying, well, because of my righteousness the Lord has brought me in to possess the land. But it is because of the wickedness of these nations that the Lord is driving them out from before you. One of the things you have to keep in mind is Israel is conquering the promised land. It's not just about God playing favorites with Israel and getting rid of these people, and it's just a messy thing, and so we're just going to get rid of them. No, it's because God had been patient with these people, and they didn't turn around. When God gives warnings to the Israelites, don't pick up the ways of these people that you're conquering. Why? Because God's wiping them out for a reason. Because they're doing great wickedness. Beloved, when God says, don't do the things of the world, don't act like the world. He's dead serious about it. He's dead serious about it. I've been talking to people, and they've been sharing with me their testimonies and what God's been doing in their life. And it is so sad, it grieves my heart to think of people coming to our church who are comfortable enough in their sin that they don't see any reason to change. And I wish I was a better hellfire brimstone preacher, you know? Gang, there is a reason Jesus is coming back to judge the world. Don't you start messing with the things that are the reason he's coming back to judge. Don't you have a part of these things? And so this judgment, this is part of what's happening, why why the Moabites weren't wiped out yet, why the Ammonites weren't going to be wiped out yet. Now, they're still pretty bad, but the Amorites, God had it up to here with them. And so God says, take them on. Verse 26, for Heshbon was the city of Sihon, king of the Amorites, who had fought against the former king of Moab and had taken all his land from his hand as far as the Arnon. Therefore, those who speak in Proverbs say, and then he gives us this top 40 tune, okay? He gives us the little words of this lady. This was on hit radio, okay? Come to Heshbon, let it be built, let the city of Sihon be repaired. Now, what you're going to get over these next couple verses is you're going to get the words of Sihon's victory song that he used to sing about how awesome he was. So this will make, if you've got to keep in mind, the first couple verses are about Sihon's boasting, saying, come to Heshbon, let it be built, let the city of Sihon be repaired. For fire went out from Heshbon, a flame from the city of Sihon. It consumed Ar of Moab, the lords of the heights of the Arnon. Woe to you, Moab. You have perished, O people of Chemosh. He has given his sons as fugitives and his daughters into captivity to Sihon, the king of the Amorites. He's boasting over the day when he conquered the Moabites. When he, the Sihon, challenged the Moabites. Now, what happens is that Israel takes this top 40 tunes and they do a remix. You know what a remix is, right? You know where you take something that Elvis has sung and you put a more modern beat to it. You know, they can do this kind of stuff. And so they add, oh, it mentions the people of Chemosh. Chemosh was the king, was the god of the Moabites. He is also known among other peoples as Molech, as Milcom. This is the guy that they would heat up in the furnace and burn their babies. This is how wicked these people are. He says, but Israel adds verse 30, which is, but we have shot at them. Heshbon has perished as far as Dibon, another city. Then we laid waste as far as Nopha, which reaches to Medeba. So the Israelites add to this top 40 song saying, by the way, they thought they were such hot stuff. Well, they were nothing. We took care of them. Verse 31, thus Israel dwelt in the land of the Amorites. Then Moses sent to spy out Jazer, and they took its villages and drove out the Amorites that lived there. Chapter 21, verse 31, and they turned and went up by the way to Bashan. So Og, king of Bashan, went out against them, he and all his people, to battle at Edrei. Bashan. Now, Bashan is what's... And you will see this throughout your Bible reading. You'll see this name pop up over and over again. Bashan. This is the Sea of Galilee, the Jordan River, the Dead Sea. Bashan is this area. Today it's known as the Golan Heights. This is part of the territory that Israel took from Syria in the Six-Day War. And so this whole area to the east of Galilee and to the north is called Bashan. It's a great place for raising cattle. Boy, this thing just pops and does everything, does it? Okay. Verse 34. So they came out to battle at Edrei. Then the Lord said to Moses, do not fear him, for I have delivered him into your hand with all his people and his land. And you shall do to him as you did to Sihon, king of the Amorites, who dwelt at Heshbon. Now, Og is also considered an Amorite. And so this is that building one victory after another. Now, look, you just took care of Sihon. So don't be afraid of Og. Take care of Og. So they defeated him, his sons and all his people, until there was no survivor left. They took possession of the land. Now, Og was a kind of an ordinary guy. He was a little, I think he played for the Lakers, you know, or something. This guy's a big guy. Deuteronomy says, let's see, where is this? Deuteronomy 3:11. King Og of Bashan was the last survivor of the giant Rephaites. His bed was made of iron and was more than 13 feet long, 6 feet wide. It can still be seen in the Ammonite city of Rabbah. Now, that's what Moses wrote back in the day of Deuteronomy. Don't go look for Rabbah and look for his bed. But back in Moses' day, they still had the bed there. 13 feet long. That's a very big bed. Okay? So this guy is huge. You remember one of the reasons why the Israelites didn't want to take the promised land 40 years earlier? What were they afraid of? Giants. And technically, they haven't really entered the promised land yet. You know, in one way you can fudge and say they're starting to conquer the promised land because the Israelites will settle here. But you can also make a case saying, well, they haven't really crossed the Jordan River yet. And they're already facing giants. You know, when you make decisions based on some fear, saying, well, I'll never be able to do this thing. Better be careful there. Better be careful, buckaroo. Because giants are everywhere. You know what the truth is? You can take on the giants. You actually can. You can. When they cross the Jordan, they're going to handle the giants. But because they're learning a step at a time, a battle at a time, and they handle Og. I mean, Og's got a pretty short little paragraph here. They take care of the dude. I mean, 13, I don't know if he was 13 feet, or maybe he just rolled around in bed a lot. I don't know. 13 feet, that's a huge bed. I mean, my gosh. Goliath wasn't the only giant that ever lived. I mean, Goliath had brothers. There's all kinds of giants. God is bigger than the giants. And God is on your side. That's what really counts. That's what really counts. Why should I be afraid if God is on my side? Paul writes in Romans chapter 8, he says, what shall we say to these things? If God is for us, who can be against us? God's on our side. Numbers chapter 22. Numbers chapter 22. Then the children of Israel moved and camped in the plains of Moab on the side of the Jordan across from Jericho. This is where the entrance turnstiles are to the promised land. Okay, this is where you go into the promised land. This is the entrance to Disneyland. This is the entrance to the park. This is where they collect the tickets. The plains of Moab. Let's do a little map thing here. So they had been at Kadesh. They've circled around here. There's the land of Edom here. They've just conquered Sihon and Og. There's Jericho where they're going. Here's the Jordan River. You're going to see a little circle of hills here. And as we scoop in, there's a little lowered area here along the Jordan River. It's called the Plains. We call it the Plains of Moab. And if we swing around from Jericho, see, it's all in a flat area in the floodplain of the Jordan. This is where they're camped out now, in the Plains of Moab. That's where they're settling down. They're going to be here for a couple of weeks as they kind of gather, as they regroup, as they get ready to cross the river. Verse 2. Now Balak, the son of Zippor, saw all that Israel had done to the Amorites. So word had been out. He'd been watching CNN or Fox News or whatever. He'd been watching the daily reports of the battlefront and what happened to Sihon, you know, who had really beat him at the last, you know, March Madness Final Four. I mean, you know, Sihon had beaten him and taken some of his land, you know. And now the Israelites just march all over him. They take care of Og the giant, you know. Should keep up the basketball pictures here, you know. So they've taken care of everybody. They've beat Cleveland, you know. And now they're back. Verse 3, and Moab was exceedingly afraid of the people because they were many. And Moab was sick with dread because of the children of Israel. Balak is the king of the Moabites. That's that area just south of where they're camped right now. Moab. The Moabites were the descendants of Abraham's nephew Lot. Remember, Lot was the guy that had to get rescued by the angel from Sodom and Gomorrah. And he only made it out of Sodom and Gomorrah with his two daughters. His wife stopped and turned around, turned to salt. Remember that whole story in Genesis 19? Lot ends up with his two daughters, and they get him drunk, and there's a very strange, bizarre, sicko, incestuous thing going on, and he gets his daughters pregnant while he's drunk. The Moabites are that result. They came from that strange thing. The Ammonites were from the other daughter. And it says the Moab, so they're kind of related to the Israelites, kind of a, you know, offshoot cousin, the weird uncle thing, you know. And they were exceedingly afraid. They were exceedingly afraid. Think of the Moabite situation. You hear, you're kind of, you finally got rid of the fears of Sihon, your kind of things have settled down, and now you've got this 2 million people that are camping out on your front doorstep. And talk about an illegal alien problem. You know, that they're afraid that illegal aliens are taking all their jobs. They're drinking all their water. They're eating all the food. They're going to ruin everything. They don't know what to do. The Moabites are afraid of these Israelites. But what's really strange, I don't know how they could have found out, but if only they could have found out what God wanted. In Deuteronomy, we'll read, then the Lord said to me, this is what God was saying to Moses while this was all happening. Do not harass Moab, nor contend with them in battle, for I will not give you any of their land as a possession, because I have given Ar to the descendants of Lot as a possession. Now, Ar is the land where the pirates come from. Ar. No, we'll see. Ar was that river down in the bottom that was halfway down the Sea of Gap, the Sea of the Dead Sea. And see, what's funny is that what you're going to read about is a new attack on Israel. It's not a frontal assault with swords, but it's much more subtle. We won't actually get to the actual attack for about 3 or 4 more chapters. And it's not what they expect. It's not rough economic times. Somebody sneaks in the back door and poisons them, in a sense. Because these Moabites are afraid. They figured they got to do something. And you know what the strangest irony is? They actually had nothing to be afraid of. Because the Israelites at this moment were still following God. And at this moment, God was saying, don't you touch the Moabites. But the Moabites don't know this. And so they're freaked out, and they've got to come up with a plan. Verse 4. So Moab said to the elders of Midian. Now this company will lick up everything around us as an ox licks up the grass of the field. And Balak, the son of Zippor, was king of the Moabites at that time. Now, it mentions the elders of Midian. There's more than just Moabites involved. Midian, technically, is located to the south, way to the south. Even the south of Edom is where the Midianites lived. But apparently there were some Midianites that had migrated up to the Moabites. And so there's Moabites, there's Midianites, and Balak, whose name means devastator, he's the king of the Moabites. And so verse 5, so he says, we got to do something. So verse 5, then he sent messengers to Balaam, the son of Beor, at Pethor, which is near the river in the land of the sons of his people, to call him, saying, look, a people has come from Egypt. See, they cover the face of the earth and are settling next to me. Now, it mentions Balaam from Pethor. It's kind of funny because he is a soothsayer. He's a diviner. He's a guy that does magic tricks. And he comes from the city called Soothsayer, from the city called Magic Tricks. It's located, here's Jericho, where the Israelites are camped out near. Pethor is up here on the Euphrates River. Up in the northern area of what would be modern Syria nowadays. And so so Balaam's not a local. But he's a guy, you know, I think he was in the Yellow Pages or something, under Rent-a-Prophet or something like that. You know, prophets for hire or prophets for profit, you know, something like that. I don't know. But he hears about this guy, and his name Balaam, his name means not of the people. I just thought that was kind of strange. The more you look at Balaam, you're going to start asking yourself, where do I put Balaam in my head? Is he a good guy? Is he a bad guy? Is he a prophet? Is he not a prophet? Is he a believer? Is he not a believer? We'll try to answer some of this. You're going to see that Balaam is going to be hired to put a curse on the Israelites because he's got a knack for doing that kind of stuff. He's not going to be able to do it because actually at the moment God still loves the Israelites, and we'll see this in a moment. As you follow the story, tonight we're going to get introduced to Balaam in chapters 23 and 24. We're going to be looking next week at some of the prophecies of Balaam, things that he will speak during this little episode. And you're going to find out that the guy says some amazing things, some things that we look at as being right on prophetic. As you turn the chapter to chapter 25, that's when the enemy comes in through the back door. And you're going to find something strange happening where suddenly the Israelites start, these young, beautiful Moabite women start coming into camp and doing silly little cutie little dances. And next thing they know, the Israelite men are having sex with these Moabite women and worshiping their gods. And things get really ugly. You don't find out until you get to chapter 31 that it was all Balaam's idea. Balaam is the one that cooked up the idea of sending the Moabite women into the Israelite camp. I kind of think that he figured, well, God's not going to curse them because they're like following him and he loves them. So let's get them to not follow him. Cooks up this plan. As I see it, Balaam is a fellow with two problems. One of his problems is money. It's one of his driving forces, is the big buck. You're going to see him offered a lot of money to make Balak's problems go away. And at first, it looks like he's going to be a man who stands on principle. And no, I will not take your money. Oh no, I must always do the right thing. But I kind of think that as you read the story goes on, you find out there's a little more to the story. Peter warns his readers about false teachers who will lead them astray. And he says, they have forsaken the right way and gone astray, following the way of Balaam, the son of Beor, who loved the wages of unrighteousness. See, he loved his paycheck. And he figured out a way to get paid. That's the driving thing that drives Balaam, is his quest for the buck, the almighty buck. I understand that in our current economy, we all are concerned about finances. But let me just throw out a little bit of a concerned warning. That when finances become the sole decision, the sole thing that drives your decisions, you are opening up the door to maybe going some wrong directions. Don't get me wrong. You need to provide for your family. You need to have a job. You need to be doing those kind of things. But when all of my decisions are based on dollars, then I close a whole bunch of doors to God in my life. Because God, every once in a while, might want me to go through a door that doesn't bring in quite as much income as the other one. But when God wants me to go through that thing, I need to go through it. Paul writes, I'm ahead of myself. Here we go. It says, now godliness with contentment is great gain, for we brought nothing into this world. It is certain we can carry nothing out. And having food and clothing, with these we shall be content. But those who desire to be rich fall into temptation and a snare, and into many foolish and harmful lusts, which drown men in destruction and perdition. For the love of money is a root of all kinds of evil, for which some have strayed from the faith into their greediness and pierced themselves through with many sorrows. Be careful about this. This is one of Balaam's big problems. It's an underlying cause is money. The second one is sex. This is his other issue. Not his own sexual sins, but the fact that he encouraged other people into sexual sins. And you won't get the full evidence of this till you get to Numbers 31. He's like the Hugh Hefner of prophets. This is who Balaam is. When Jesus rebukes the church at Pergamos in the book of Revelation, he says, I have a few things against you because you have there those who hold the doctrine or the teaching of Balaam, who taught Balak. This is what Balaam did. He taught him something. He taught Balak to put a stumbling block before the children of Israel, to eat things sacrificed to idols, and to commit sexual immorality. This is what Balaam was all about. He didn't have any sexual restrictions. And so he said, anything goes. This is the way he taught. This is the way he instructed people. Paul writes in 1 Thessalonians 4, this is the will of God, your sanctification, that you abstain from sexual immorality. He says in 1 Corinthians 6:18, flee sexual immorality. Gang, God is real concerned that we keep sex where it was designed for. That is within marriage. This is God's ways. This is God's best, is that sex is a good thing. God designed it. God invented it to be inside of marriage. And you know what? I don't know about girls. I know us guys, because I are one. From the land of R. We can talk ourselves into anything. Don't do it. Don't do it. God says sex is for marriage, period. Keep yourselves pure, beloved. This is God's desire for you. This is God's will for you. You need to do the right thing. This is one of Balaam's problems. Verse 6. So where are we? So Balak is calling Balaam, and he says, part of his message is verse 6, therefore, please come at once. Curse this people for me, for they are too mighty for me. Perhaps I shall be able to defeat them and drive them out of the land. For I know that he whom you bless is blessed, and he whom you curse is cursed. And so he wants Balaam, Balak wants Balaam to curse these people. And he says, because I know that you've got some pull with the gods. You know to say the magic words. Deuteronomy, it says, nevertheless, the Lord your God would not listen to Balaam, but the Lord your God turned the curse into a blessing for you because the Lord your God loves you. I like that. God's on Israel's side. Verse 7. So the elders of Moab and the elders of Midian departed with the diviner's fee in their hand, and they came to Balaam and spoke to him the words of Balak. So Balak, the king, sends messengers, and he gives them, gives them a check, and says, here, you got to pay the fee, you got to pay the guy something, and he said to them, verse 8, Balaam says to them, lodge here tonight, and I will bring back word to you as the Lord. You see, it's all in capitals. What's that mean when Lord is in all capitals? Yahweh. It's Yahweh. The Hebrew underneath is Yahweh. Balaam, this prophet, says, I will bring back to you the word as Yahweh speaks to me. So the princes of Moab stayed with Balaam. So he says, okay, guys, I like this idea. We'll see how this works. So you stay here tonight and I'll see what God says, what Yahweh says. He calls God Yahweh. This is God's, ladies, this is God's covenant name, whatever that means. I know the ladies are studying covenant on Thursday mornings. This is a name generally reserved for those who have a relationship with God. That's what a covenant is. So was Balaam a believer? I'll give you two answers. Maybe. It's possible. He's going to say some amazing things. Chapters 23 and 24 are filled with amazing prophecies. Absolutely amazing. So maybe. Maybe not. How's that for decisiveness? Maybe or maybe not. It is also possible that Balaam only had a passing acquaintance with God. The New Testament lists him in the ranks of false teachers. Well, why would Balaam refer to God as Yahweh if he wasn't a true believer? Well, keep in mind, who's he being hired to curse? The Israelites. And what's the name of their God? See, he does his homework. He knows that Yahweh, everybody knows that Yahweh is Israel's God. Everybody knows this. Yahweh has made a famous name for himself for the curses and plagues on Egypt, the parting of the Red Sea and all this stuff. Everybody's kind of a little bit afraid of Yahweh. Doesn't hurt for a good diviner, a good prophet, to know his gods. So it's possible that he's saying this simply as a way of puffing up his client. He wants to get paid. And what better than to say that you're on a first-name basis with the God of the people you're supposed to curse? You following me? So there's two different possibilities here. Contrary to popular opinion, God sometimes does speak to unbelievers. And sometimes he gives them messages. You see this throughout the Bible, to Abimelech, to Pharaoh, to Nebuchadnezzar, before he became a believer. God does sometimes speak to unbelievers. So, verse 9. So then God came to Balaam and said, "Who are these men with you?" Now, it's not that God doesn't know. He just wants to hear it from Balaam. And notice that it said, then God came to Balaam. The Hebrew word there is Elohim. That's the generic God name for God. The mighty ones. This is what Elohim is. And you'll notice, pay attention here, about when God is called God, when he's called Lord with all capitals. And you'll see that there might be something to this idea that Balaam is just trying to snooker these people. It's possible. It's possible. So, verse 10. So Balaam said to God, "Balak, the son of Zippor, the king of Moab, has sent to me, saying, 'Look, a people has come out of Egypt, and they cover the face of the earth. Come now, curse them for me. Perhaps I shall be able to overpower them and drive them out.' And God said to Balaam, 'You shall not go with them. You shall not curse the people, for they are blessed.'" So Balaam rose in the morning and said to the princes of Balak, "Go back to your land, for Yahweh has refused to give me permission to go with you." Now, at this point, you kind of get the feeling that Balaam's okay. He's right on. God speaks to him and he does what God says. You kind of get that idea. Verse 14, "And the princes of Moab rose and went to Balak." So this is not the 300-mile trip. I mean, this takes some time here. They don't just jump on an airplane. This is going to take a while. "And they went to Balak saying, 'Balaam refuses to come with us.' Then Balak sent princes more numerous and more honorable than they." The word for honorable, it might mean that these guys are more famous. But the word al-kabad, it means heavy weight. It could be that these guys have more poundage on them than the other guys. It could be something like that. It could be that they're carrying more money. So that could be some of the thing. What if Balak raises the stakes a little bit? Verse 16, "And they came to Balaam and said to him, 'Thus says Balak the son of Zippor, let nothing, please let nothing hinder you from coming to me, for I will certainly honor you greatly. It's like give you a big paycheck. And I will do whatever you say to me. Therefore, please come, curse this people for me. Then Balaam answered and said to the servants of Balak, though Balak were to give me his house full of silver and gold, hint, 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 I could not go beyond the word of Yahweh, my God, to do less or more. Now, this mention of the whole house of silver and gold, I don't know if maybe he's dropping a little hint. I don't know. It could be. Because of what we know of him later on, it could be. And he calls Yahweh his God. Again, it could be that he's a believer. It could be he's trying to impress his client. Okay? Verse 19. Now, therefore, please, you also stay here tonight, that I may know what more Yahweh will say to me. But see, when God shows up, what does it say? It says God came to Balaam, not Yahweh. So this is why it's kind of interesting. And God came to Balaam at night and said to him, if the men come to you, come to call you, rise and go with them. But only the word which I speak to you, that you shall do. So Balaam rose in the morning, saddled his donkey, and went with the princes of Moab. Now, and so this time God says, go with them. Now, it kind of sounds like God changes his mind throughout the story. God kind of go back and forth. Go with them, don't go with them. Go with them, don't go with them. I don't think that's what's happening. I think what God is trying to do is make sure that Balaam understands clearly, buddy, you better do it the way I want you to do it. Because I think God has a message for Balak. And the message is this, Israel, this is my people. I bless them. I do not curse them. I think that's the message God wants to get across. So the first time he says, you just hold off, buddy. You ain't going nowhere. The second time God says, okay, I'll let you go, but you be sure now. You be sure to say what I tell you to say. So verse 22. The talking donkey. Okay, verse 22. Here we go. Then God's anger was aroused because he went. You can translate it, because of the way he went. And the angel of the Lord took his stand in the way as an adversary against him. And he was riding on his donkey and his two servants were with him. Now again, it mentions God's anger. It sounds like God just can't make up his mind. But I don't think that's what's happening. I think that God is watching Balaam go, and then he watches Balaam's little greedy eyes glisten, thinking about the payday at the end. And thinking about, man, I can hardly wait to take Balak for all that he's worth. I can hardly wait. And so God sends this angel of the Lord to knock a message into Balaam. Now, this angel of the Lord, this is a person, this is a unique specific individual in the Old Testament. These words link together, the angel or the messenger of Yahweh. This is a unique person. This is the guy that stopped Abraham from sacrificing Isaac. This is the guy who appeared in the burning bush in Exodus chapter 3. This is the one who appeared to Gideon in Judges. This is the one who appeared to Samson's parents in Judges 13. There's over 50 times this phrase appears in the Old Testament. I believe this is Jesus Christ showing up in a form before he is born in Bethlehem. We call this a theophany. Don't think of angel as being a created angel with the wings and stuff. The word angel means messenger. That's the concept of what an angel is. He is the messenger of Yahweh. He is giving him a message. So, verse 23. Now the donkey saw the angel of the Lord standing in the way with his drawn sword in his hand. And the donkey turned aside out of the way and went into the field. So Balaam struck the donkey to turn her back onto the road. That's kind of funny. The awesome, powerful prophet of God doesn't see the angel. But the donkey, does. Isn't that kind of funny? This is kind of just, you get a chuckle out of that. I don't know. Verse 24, then the angel of the Lord stood in a narrow path between the vineyards, with a wall on this side and a wall on that side. And when the donkey saw the angel of the Lord, she pushed herself against the wall and crushed Balaam's foot against the wall. So he struck her again. Then the angel... See, all Balaam could think of is this donkey is just going wacko. What happened to old Bessie? I mean, why is she doing this? The angel of the Lord went further and stood in a narrow place where there was no way to turn, either to the right hand or to the left. And when the donkey saw the angel of the Lord, she lay down under Balaam. So Balaam's anger was aroused, and he struck the donkey with his staff. Then Yahweh opened the mouth of the donkey, and she said to Balaam, "What have I done to you that you have struck me these three times?" Or maybe a little bit of a British accent, I don't know. This is quite a very proper donkey, I think. And Balaam said to the donkey, "Well, because you have abused me, I wish there were a sword in my hand, for now I would kill you." So, talking donkey. Why doesn't Balaam seem surprised? I don't know. A dad liked to read his two young sons fairy tales at night. Having a deep-rooted sense of humor, he often ad-libbed the parts. I don't know of any son, that father who would, you know, speak with silly voices as he reads to his boys. And one day, his youngest son was sitting in his first grade class as the teacher was reading the story of the three little pigs. Three little pigs. She came to the part of the story where the first pig was trying to acquire building materials for his home. She said, "And so the pig went up to the man carrying a load of straw and said, 'Pardon me, sir, but might I have some of that straw to build my house with?' Then the teacher asked the class, 'And what do you think the man said?' And that little boy raised his hand and said, I know, he said, 'Holy smoke, a talking pig!'" Now see, that makes sense. Why doesn't Balaam say this? It's like, "Holy smoke, a talking donkey, what?" I don't need to go do what Balaam. We'd go to join the circus. I mean, we can make big bucks here. A talking donkey. Maybe Balaam just has watched too many episodes of
"Hello, I'm Mr. Ed."
Does anybody know the song? Nobody knows the song? Okay. Some people find it amazing that a donkey is talking. I'm also a little bit amazed that Balaam answers it. That's kind of a little bit of an amazing thing. A city man was tooling around a country road when his car sputtered to a complete stop near a field filled with cows. The driver, getting out to see what the matter was, he noticed one of the cows was looking at him.
"I believe it's your radiator," said the cow.
The man jumped right out of his city slicker britches. He ran to the nearest farmhouse. He knocked on the door and he said, "A cow just gave me advice about my car." He shouted, his waving his arms, and the farmer nonchalantly leaned out towards past the door and glanced down the field. And he said, "Was it the cow with the two black spots on it?" "Why, yes, that's the one." The guy said excitedly, "Oh, well, that there's Ethel. Don't pay no attention to her. She don't know a thing about cars." Okay, no more jokes. So the donkey said to Balaam, "Am I not your donkey on which you have ridden ever since I became yours to this day? Was I ever disposed to do this to you?" And he said, "No." Then the Lord opened Balaam's eyes, and he saw the angel of the Lord standing in the way with his drawn sword in his hand. And he bowed his head and fell flat on his face. Now, it says he bows his head, he falls flat on his face. He's worshiping this angel. If this was an ordinary angel, he would not allow this. You see this in the book of Revelation. Ordinary angels do not allow themselves to be worshipped. The Son of God is different. He does allow worship. Verse 32, and the angel of the Lord said to him, why have you struck your donkey these three times? Behold, I have come out to stand against you because your way is perverse before me. The donkey saw me and turned aside from me these three times. If she had not turned aside from me, surely I would also have killed you by now and let her live. He says, your way is perverse. See, God knows his heart. God knows what he's trying to do. God can read his mind. He could see Balaam cooking up ways to make money. And he says, if she had not turned aside, I would have killed you, buddy. You know, delays aren't always bad. You know, sometimes the little detours, sometimes the little sidetracks aren't always bad. Sometimes that donkey just saved your life. And Balaam said to the angel of the Lord, I have sinned, for I did not know you stood in the way against me. Now, therefore, if it displeases you, I will turn back. Then the angel of the Lord said to Balaam, Go with the men. Only the word that I speak to you, that you shall speak. So Balaam went with the princes of Balak. So God has given, feels like he's given Balaam enough warnings, and he lets him go. Now, when Balak heard that Balaam was coming, he went out to meet him at the city of Moab, which is on the border of the Arnon, the boundaries of the territory. The Arnon, that's this river here. So Balaam has come all the way up here from Syria and has come all the way down here, and he meets him down here. Israel is camped out here, and he meets him on a city out here somewhere. And Balak said to Balaam, did I not earnestly send to you calling for you? Why did you not come to me? Am I not able to honor you? What, you don't like my money? And Balaam said to Balak, look, I have come to you. Now, have I any power at all to say anything? The word that God puts in my mouth, that I must speak. So Balaam went with Balak, and they came to Kiriath Hutzot. The name means a city of streets or city of the highway. We're not really sure where this is. Verse 40, then Balak offered, but we think the idea is that they moved up closer to where the Israelites are camping. Then Balak offered oxen and sheep and sent some to Balaam and to the princes who were with him. Now, the thing is that the ritual has begun. The divination rituals have begun. It will involve sacrifices. Animals will be sacrificed. Sometimes the divining, sometimes the figuring out what the gods are saying involves opening up the animal and looking at the liver or doing different strange things. And they would look for certain signs to try to figure out what was going on. And verse 41, and so it was the next day that Balak took Balaam and brought him up to the high places of Baal, that from there he might observe the extent of the people. Now, the idea is that each time there will be sacrifices. I can't remember, there's four or five times that they will go through this ritual where they will sacrifice. They will go to a different place to look at these people to hope something comes up, you know, and hope that God will say something, and the ritual begins. And we'll find out what Balaam has to say next week. Let's stand and pray. Father, we thank you for your word. And we thank you that you are a God who loves his people. You are a God who protects his people. And Lord, may you help us as we try to follow you with everything we have, with a whole heart. Lord, we want to honor you. We want to be useful to you. So Lord, would you challenge us? Would you strengthen us? Would you encourage us? Would you love on us? Would you continue to pour your Spirit on us? Would you help us when it's necessary to pull out our swords and to swing our arms and to take the steps we need to for the victory to happen? Would you keep us, Lord, from making stupid decisions based on the wrong thing? Would you help us to not have hearts that are only focused on money and sex? And instead, Lord, may we have hearts that are focused on you and your leading. So direct us.